Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince. There is something about summer that makes you really appreciate good bedding. And that's when I started paying more attention to what we were actually sleeping on.
Quince makes high-quality bedding from materials like 100% European linen and organic cotton. And the difference is genuinely easy to feel. Their organic cotton sheets are breathable and perfect for warm nights.
They've got everything you need to make your bed feel cooler and lighter for summer. Sheets, linen shams, duvet covers. Plus, they have mulberry silk pillowcases and eye masks, which feel like such a small upgrade that makes a huge difference.
And the prices are wild. Everything at Quince is 50 to 80% less than comparable brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not markup. That's just the smarter way to shop.
Seriously, if you've been sleeping on the same sheets for too long and wondering why you're waking up warm, this is your sign. I noticed the difference right away, and then even more after a few washes when everything got softer.
Make your summer bedding feel better. Go to quince.com/centuries for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/centuries for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/centuries.
Hey, I've got the campaign brief ready, built from last quarter's data and the competitive landscape.
Approved. Oh, agents, where would we be without you?
Somewhere with a lot more tabs open.
Create your first Monday agent in minutes at monday.com.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Leslie Prier wasn't the most punctual person when it came to her job. She was known to be a few minutes late here and there. So when she didn't show up promptly at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, May 2nd, 2001, her boss wasn't really surprised. But late was one thing. Not showing up at all? Well, that was another. As the minutes ticked by with no word from Leslie, her boss, Brett Reedy, started to get nervous. He called to check on her and got no answer. Here's ABC reporter Stephanie Ramos explaining what happened next.
This morning was a little different because she was later than usual, and he instantly thought, well, maybe her bus broke down.
Maybe if I go to her house
or I just kind of retrace what would be her steps, I could find her.
What he did next struck police as a little forward. He left the advertising company he ran to check on Leslie himself. To make sure there wouldn't be any weirdness about it, he called Leslie's husband, a man named Carl, whom everyone called Sandy, and suggested the two meet at the house on Drummond Avenue in Chevy Chase, Maryland. They pushed open the front door.
They see blood, they see furniture that's been tipped over, they see that something's gone wrong here. They can't find the dog and they can't find Leslie.
They'd seen enough to call 911.
There's blood in the foyer, mm-hmm. And it looks like something possibly happened. The husband's looking around.
When was the last time?
The last time the husband saw her was 7:45 this morning.
Okay. Is there a lot of blood?
But it looks like there's possibly struggle, a couple things knocked down.
Okay. Can I ask you guys to step out of the house?
Sure.
Sandy had already walked through the house and found plenty amiss. There were blood smears, and it turned out the dog had been in the basement, which was highly unusual. But he still couldn't find his wife, and he didn't seem overly concerned about it.
Sandy thinks that maybe Leslie hurt herself and is at the hospital. A neighbor stopped by, helped her out. He doesn't think the worst has happened inside his home, which it has.
Police officers who arrived at the scene did a more thorough search of the house and found Leslie's body in the shower of the primary bathroom, her disfigured head positioned beneath the running shower stream. An autopsy would soon show that Leslie had been attacked in the foyer of the house. She was choked and her head had been brutally smashed against the foyer floor until she died. Then whoever killed her made a slapdash attempt to clean up the scene, though, as Ramos said,
it just wasn't a successful cleanup.
As is expected in a case like this, police initially zeroed in on the two who found the body, Leslie's boss, who was quickly eliminated, and her husband, who was not. The couple had faced some problems. There were money issues and arguments over Leslie's drinking. Sandy's behavior gave them pause, as did his alibi. Police were sure that she and Sandy had gotten into some kind of spat, and Sandy had lost it. It was, after all, a case of classic overkill, and anyone who follows true crime knows that overkill can point to someone the victim knows. But the person who killed Leslie left behind DNA, and that technology was far enough along in 2001 to test it and eliminate Sandy. It would eventually help find who killed Leslie Prier, but it would take nearly a quarter century and a pair of fresh eyes, courtesy of some new detectives. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. I've needed therapy in my life more times than I could count. When my mom died, during bad relationships, last week when I rushed a cat to the emergency vet. Therapy can literally be a lifesaver. But can we talk about how hard it is to find a therapist who actually takes your insurance?
And it's wild because you'd never think twice about using insurance for a doctor's visit. Why should mental health be any different?
That's what got me curious about Rula. I looked into their therapist myself and I was impressed with how quickly they helped me find someone who seemed like a real fit.
That's kind of their whole thing. Rula is a healthcare company. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, and the average copay ends up being around $15 a session.
And it's not just whoever is next available. They take your goals and preferences into account, so you end up with a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who actually line up with what you're looking for.
No wait list either. Appointments as soon as tomorrow, and they stay with you through it, checking in as you go.
Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit rula.com/COTC to get started.
That's rula.com/COTC. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget.
The morning of May 2, 2001 was absolutely normal in the Prier household. Leslie Prier got up, got dressed and ready to take the bus from her home in Chevy Chase into Washington, D.C., where she worked. Her husband, Sandy Prier, had already said goodbye and left for the day. Just a normal day for a normal East Coast family.
They were your typical middle-class family.
Stephanie Ramos is an ABC reporter who has covered this case extensively, both for ABC and also for a 6-part limited-run podcast called Blood and Water. If you want a deeper dive, that's where to go. Ramos agreed to walk me through this case in an interview, so you'll hear her voice throughout the episode. Now, to understand the Prier family, you, of course, have to go back a ways. We'll start with Leslie. She had been born Leslie Ann Jennings on October 5th, 1951, in North Kingston, Rhode Island. She came from a military family. Her parents were William Elwood and Miriam Pullen Jennings, and Dad Bill enlisted in the Navy in 1943. Like a lot of military families, hers moved around a lot. That's why Ramos remembers her as having grown up in Washington, yet I found yearbook photos of her from Florida, where she graduated from Pensacola High School and went on to study at the University of Florida, finishing in 1973. Leslie was one of 8 siblings, and by all accounts, she was close to all of them. In 1969, she served as maid of honor at her sister Robin's wedding, where she wore a crushed blue velvet skirt with a white crepe blouse and ice blue ribbon headpieces. I know that because of the wedding announcement that ran in the December 28th Pensacola News Journal. Anyway, at the University of Florida, she got a bachelor's in journalism. And I'll mention, she was stunning. I mean, of course, it doesn't matter in the whole scheme of things, But looking at the photos of her in her youth, it's clear she was one of those jaw-droppers. And it wasn't just that she had a well-proportioned face with a jawline women pay money for, but she had a spark in her eye. I'm not the only one who saw it. Former co-worker and friend Linda Lyle told Ramos,
"Oh, she was beautiful. She had a quiet manner. She was dainty to me."
While in Florida, Leslie met Carl Eugene Prier III, known to everyone as Sandy. He had been born in Japan, but moved with his parents as a sibling stateside when he was 1 year old. He graduated high school in Hampton, Virginia. After that, he went to Pensacola State College in Florida, where he worked on the school newspaper. At some point, he shifted to become a Florida Gator, where he got his bachelor's in advertising. The couple met in the early 1970s and clearly hit it off, because on October 26, 1974, they married. The two eventually settled in Chevy Chase, Maryland in 1982, where they would raise their daughter, Lauren. Now, Chevy Chase sits right on the D.C. border in Montgomery County, Maryland. It's generally an affluent, walkable, family-oriented suburb with stately, historic homes. It's not cheap to live there. It's one of the wealthiest and most highly educated places in the country. But the couple worked hard to make it happen. It's clear the family was close-knit. And I don't just mean the three members of the Chevy Chase Prier family. I found an article in the Pensacola News Journal from 1981 that profiled Leslie's mom, Miriam, as a woman who, and I'm quoting here, came out of the kitchen and into the community at age 40. By that point, only one of her eight children was still living at home. The story mentions that three were married. Leslie would have been among them. In fact, Leslie and Sandy's daughter, Lauren, is featured in a picture alongside the profile, holding her grandmother's hand as they walk along a beach. For the record, Miriam says in the story that having eight children was, quote, stupid. It's crazy for someone to have that many children unless you're affluent enough to have lots of help so you can enjoy the time when they are growing up, end quote. Makes sense to me. Anyway, it seems Leslie emulated her mom's later-in-life community activism. She volunteered at a local library, teaching English to immigrants and newcomers. Family and friends describe her as gentle, intelligent, and kind. So when word spread in May 2001 that she'd been killed, it made no sense. It also, strangely, made few headlines. Usually, cases I cover on crimes of the centuries were huge news when they happened. It's in the show description, in fact. But in searching newspaper archives for contemporary coverage of Leslie's death, there were only a few examples. The Washington Post reported on it May 4th, 2001, when her death was ruled a homicide, and the Post ran another story a week later when the 911 call was released. I found Leslie's obituary, which described her parents and seven siblings as, quote, deeply saddened by her loss, end quote. A sentiment I know is a ridiculous understatement. But I couldn't find the stories you usually see about a case like this. Ones about the family searching for answers or the anniversary passing without a conviction. And that could be because police were certain they knew who did it. Sandy Prier. In an interrogation, they told him as much.
Suck it up and admit to it, and so you can move on. And that's what you really need to do.
In fairness to police, Sandy wasn't the only initial person of interest. First, they were curious to know about her boss, who, within 2 hours of her not showing up for work, was at her front door. Ramos explained.
This is a little fishy for investigators because they're like, well, when does a manager care so much about how a, you know, an employee got to work? Like, would your manager, if you were late for work, would your manager say, I'm going to go to this person's house? That doesn't happen very often.
But it turned out he just had a bad feeling because while Leslie was known to be late, they had talked about it recently. As he told Ramos,
it was odd that she wasn't there, only because she was kind of on probation, if you will, with me. It wasn't a handwritten probation or anything like that. It was just like, look, you got to make it by 10.
So he was a mixture of annoyed and concerned. He just felt compelled to check things out. It helped that he knew the area too, having grown up not far from where Sandy and Leslie lived.
Great neighborhood. I had about probably six friends that lived on this street from elementary school. And right here at this intersection, I was often a patrol for elementary school right here for this crossing.
Police ruled out Reedy. They also asked Sandy and Lauren, who by then was in her early 20s, for a list of people close to the family so they could rule those folks out too. But it doesn't seem they paid much attention to that list. They were pretty darn sure Leslie's husband was their guy. And for starters, they found his behavior after his wife's death a bit odd. For example, when he got to the house, instead of quickly growing alarmed at the sight of blood in his foyer, he dismissed it as maybe Leslie just hurting herself. Then, when he was questioned by police, he admitted things hadn't been peachy on the home front.
They were actually struggling financially, and that was another tip for investigators. Sandy, during his interviews with investigators, talked about their financial struggles and how Leslie drank too much, and they would often get into arguments when she was drinking.
This is from a police interview with Sandy.
Was this a routine with her to get fairly well inebriated every night?
Yes.
In the days before DNA, I have no doubt Sandy Prier would have been arrested. But this was 2001, and DNA had been used in trials for more than a decade. To the department's credit, it had processed the scene well and found a blood sample that didn't belong to Leslie and didn't belong to Sandy either. So while many officers still believe Sandy Prier had killed his wife, they knew they couldn't prove it. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
It's easy to write off bedroom performance issues as part of getting older. Most guys do. But ED is more treatable than you might think, and Hims makes it simple to find out what's really going on.
Hims connects you with licensed healthcare providers online, so you get simple access to legitimate ED treatment options from home. No awkward appointments, no pharmacy lines. You just complete a simple online intake, and a provider reviews it to figure out if treatment's right for you.
That includes Sildenafil, generic for Viagra, available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name version. And if that's not the right fit, there are other treatment options too, so you can find what actually works for your body.
It's straightforward, transparent, and just designed to make getting care feel easy.
To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, and more, visit hims.com/COTC.
That's hims.com/COTC.
hims.com/COTC, not available in all 50 states. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Sildenafil is a generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris.
After her mother was murdered, Lauren Prier was allowed to go inside the home to gather her belongings. She described what she saw in one of the most heartbreaking parts of Stephanie Ramos's Blood and Water series.
They know she was killed by the front door. There was like this, like her, the back of her head was smashed against the wall, and then there was like blood stains down the wall. I think she was just trying to escape.
As much blood as was visible, investigators soon realized there was more that couldn't be seen by the naked eye. They sprayed luminol all over the house. That's the chemical that glows blue when it comes in contact with the iron and blood. Thanks to that chemical reaction, investigators could see evidence of that half-assed cleanup effort mentioned earlier. As Lauren went to get her belongings, she could still see the telltale blue glow surrounding her.
I had to walk through that. There was still luminol all over the hallway, all the way up the stairs, through the bedroom, my parents' master bedroom, and I stopped at their bed. I couldn't do it. I couldn't go in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it. I couldn't.
It was a shock not just to Lauren, but also to her friends. Bryce Thomas told Ramos,
Mrs. Prier was always so engaging. You know, it made you feel welcome. You don't think about these things too much as a kid, but now when you look back at it, you're like, yeah, she was more involved, really wanted to meet us and figure out who are these kids hanging out with my daughter, you know?
Within days, police told her they believed her father was the killer. She simply could not square that horrific, bloody crime scene with her father. He wasn't a violent man. He was the kind of guy who wore thick glasses and a suit and tie getup to work every day at a consultancy firm.
We just had so much love for each other, and we had so much fun together. And, you know, a lot of people or friends don't have the same relationship with their parents. Do you know what I mean?
Now, police have seen plenty of seemingly nice people commit crimes, so you can't really blame them for not dismissing Sandy based on Lauren's word. Plus, things Sandy told them just felt weird. And take this, for example. They wanted to piece together Leslie's last moments. Because the autopsy showed that Leslie had pasta remnants in her stomach, they at first wondered if she had actually died the night of May 1st, not the morning of May 2nd. So they asked Sandy what he did that Tuesday night. Sandy kind of fumbled the question.
I know what I did. I was taking some computer stuff to the dump Tuesday because I was members. I got to get there by 8 o'clock. Got to get there by 8, and I said, okay, I need to leave here by 7 or 7:15 in order to make sure that I get out there. So we have some.
He basically said he was driving around getting rid of what Ramos calls electronic waste. I mention often I've done this crime reporting thing for 30 years. Never in 30 years has electronic waste been part of an alibi in a case that I've covered. So police thought that was odd and conveniently tough to verify. Anyway, Sandy said he didn't get home until 9 p.m.
I was really beat. I went to bed around 9:30 that night. It was Tuesday night.
Your wife was home when you
wife
got there?
Wife was home when I got there. She kissed me goodnight.
Do you have dinner?
No.
Do you know she had dinner?
She would cook. She would cook like every other day, every third day or something like that. She would always cook pasta or some chicken or something like that. But that night I didn't have dinner. I'm not sure if she cooked it, and I'm not sure if she had it. I just can't remember. I just went right to bed.
You can hear why this sounds odd to investigators, right? This wasn't weeks after the murder. This was days. And he seems to struggle with answering what he'd been doing and, as importantly, what Leslie had been doing. And he had a reason for that. He said her drinking was becoming problematic enough that he was pulling away from her. Police asked how much she was drinking.
How many?
Is this important? She would have a lot. And in all honesty, it's one of the reasons why I'd kind of come home late, because it was getting hard to deal with.
It was causing issues. He didn't like how she acted when she drank, how she slurred her words and became tough to be around.
I just didn't enjoy being with someone who, in that condition, who had too much to drink. I mean, you had to make sure you whatever you said, because she could take it any other way. And when she got cranked up, man, it was shut it down. You couldn't get away from whatever that subject she may be on.
Just keep coming at you.
And it wasn't fun.
Police asked about a stain they saw on the ceiling. Sandy said it was wine from a moment when he'd lost his cool.
What that came from was she had too much to drink that night, and there was a wet glass of wine on the counter. And, you know, I just flossed it, just slung it like, just slung the wine, the glass, and I didn't let go of the glass, mm-hmm. Just slung the liquid, and I said something along the line, you don't need any more of this.
How long ago was that?
I would say that was within 2 weeks. It's been pretty recent.
So here they had a guy admitting that he lost his temper sometimes, recently. They asked if he'd ever gotten violent, and he said, well, sometimes she'd hit him in the back.
I didn't react to it, if that's what you're going to ask me.
Right.
No, I mean, I never. The most violent I ever got was I'd grab her and just say, you know, you got to snap out of it.
Like grabbing her by her shoulders?
Her shoulders, and, you know, you got to snap out of it. But I did that one time, and it, you know, really, and, you know, she, you know, hit the wall. I'm nothing, you know, smashing or anything. Hit the wall, and she's burst in tears, and I'm thinking, God, what am I doing? So I pretty much controlled myself to where I was not going to go there.
Despite the turmoil, Sandy said they never talked seriously about splitting.
We never seriously discussed it because we loved each other dearly.
Police kept coming back to Sandy, though, wanting more and more information. He started to sense they were spending more time thinking about him and not enough time trying to figure out who killed his wife. Then it must have clicked for him that in their mind, those two things overlapped. They would say things like,
"No, I'm not trying to sit here in judgment, neither is Mike. But there's some things that you gotta try to do to set things straight, especially for other folks. Because we all know what happened. And I think it'd be a travesty for Lauren, for her to go through the rest of her doggone life trying to figure out just what the hell happened.
It's bad enough for her to deal with the grief or the loss of her mother. But I think also she's a forgiving person."
In other words, we're not judging you, but come on, man. For the sake of your daughter, you need to say what happened. Don't worry, she'll forgive you. Sandy lawyered up, as he should have done in the first place. Here's Sandy telling the cops that his lawyer said to stop talking.
"I would love to respond to these questions."
"Well, you can."
"But my attorney said not to."
"A free white and over 21, Sandy. You can do any doggone thing you want to do."
"And as I said,
say any prayer." "Yes. Yes, I'm here right now. They're kind of grilling me." "Mm-hmm. Oh, I did. To a degree. All right, will do. Okay. All right, bye. I've been instructed not to talk to you."
"Via the telephone."
"Saved by the bell."
"Without my attorney present."
Saved by the bell, like he was about to confess, but his lawyer called and saved his tush.
"Got to do the right thing, man. You got to."
"I think I am. In fact, I know I am. And I'll just tell you one thing, you've got the wrong guy."
Now, I intentionally did not shape this episode to leave you hanging on whether Sandy's guilty or not. It might have made for a more dramatic telling. This poor guy died in 2017 with a cloud hanging over his head. Ramos said most of his wife's family stopped talking to him because they thought he was guilty. He never knew what happened to his wife. His daughter worried she'd live the rest of her life not knowing either. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. Okay, Scott, be honest. How many nights this month have we had zero planned for dinner by 6 p.m.?
Too many to count. That's the whole reason Home Chef's been such a lifesaver for us.
I love their 30-minute meals. Real dinner, done fast, no panic ordering takeout.
And it's not just fast, it's actually good. Fresh food delivered, easy recipes, and it tastes great.
Plus, it cuts down on the extra grocery runs, no long shopping lists, no complicated prep, and the cleanup's easy too.
It's not one size fits all either. Over 30 meal options every week. Different tastes, different dietary needs, including calorie-conscious and GLP-1 friendly meals.
The GLP-1 friendly ones come pre-portioned with dietitian-approved nutrition guidelines, high protein, high fiber, built to help with fullness and blood sugar stability without sacrificing flavor.
People really do love it. Home Chef's rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering my listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box box plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. Lauren Prier never suspected her father, Sandy, killed her mother, Leslie, in 2001.
She told me at one point she did ask him just once, did you have anything to do with this? Only because investigators kept hammering that idea. They kept mentioning it to Lauren and saying, we believe your dad did this and here's why. She asked her dad. Her dad said, absolutely not. She never asked him again.
They had a loving relationship until he died 9 years ago at the age of 67. Technically, he died of natural causes from a sudden illness, though Lauren said,
I think my dad died of a broken heart.
All Lauren knew about the case was what her father told her. He had left her mother alive and well on May 2nd, 2001, then came home to a nightmare a few hours later. Lauren said she kept in touch with the police, hoping they would someday break the case.
I never gave up. I called all the time. I knew someone knew something.
For a long time, nothing happened. And then the case was assigned to two detectives with the Montgomery County Cold Case Unit, Allison Dupuy and Tara Augustin. The two didn't know each other back in 2001, but both were in the D.C. area going to college when Leslie Prier was murdered. I'm going to refer to them as the new detectives, but these were by no means rookies. Augustin had wanted to work cold cases for most of her career. She transferred to the unit in 2022 and was paired with Dupuy, a veteran officer. The two reached out to Lauren and, through her, got to know Leslie, a woman who had died 2 decades earlier. They also pulled the old case file and the evidence that initially had been collected.
We spread everything out across a big table. It was a big mess of photos, documents, pieces of a puzzle.
They showed ABC reporter Stephanie Ramos the crime scene photos.
So this is the back door in the kitchen, and this is a drop of blood that was smeared. There's a doorway right here that separates the dining room from the kitchen. And on that doorway, there's another drop of blood that was found.
That's where unknown male DNA had been located. It hadn't matched Sandy, and it didn't match anything in the federal CODIS database either. Nor had it matched anyone else close to Leslie Prier. Any of the men in the family, Brett Reedy, the boss, her neighbors.
No one was a match.
While the original investigators knew this, it hadn't meant much to them. Like I said, they were really fixated on Sandy. I mean, one thing that stuck with them was that when cops showed up at the scene that first time about a bloody foyer and a missing woman, Sandy had seen them with her guns drawn and said, "Oh, you guys mean business." It sounded jokey to them. What kind of guy jokes when his wife's missing and there's blood everywhere? Dupuy and Augustin were able to set that aside.
These kinds of circumstances, you don't know how you're going to deal with it. Some people make jokes. Some people might be hysterical. Some people might not take it seriously at all at first. And some people take it very seriously. So I think you have different ways of dealing with this stuff, but certainly that did not help Sandy's case.
Obviously, he took things seriously once his wife's body was found, but initially, he didn't know what was happening. The original investigators held that against him, but the new ones didn't. Nor did they hold against him this important tidbit. Sandy had taken, and failed, a polygraph. Thing was, he took that test soon after detectives told him his wife's death was a homicide, not just suspicious. And polygraphs can't really tell if you're telling the truth. What they can tell is if you're having a physical response to the questions being posed to you. I mean, it's really more of a stress test than a lie detector. And Sandy was stressed. In short, Dupuy and Augustin were willing to look at things anew. To that end, they revisited that DNA profile found 20 years earlier.
So the blood evidence from the scene was submitted to this lab for forensic genetic genealogical DNA analysis.
This was September 2022, and the evidence was sent to Othram, a private forensic laboratory based in the Woodlands, Texas. Othram's job was to take the degraded crime scene evidence and build a usable DNA profile from it using their proprietary sequencing technology, something traditional testing couldn't do. Once they had that profile, they handed it back to Augustin and Dupuy, who could then upload it to a public consumer genealogy database, in this case, Family Tree DNA, and start building a family tree. The idea behind this approach is that instead of looking for an exact DNA match in a law enforcement database like CODIS, you're casting a much wider net. You're looking for partial matches, people who share some DNA with your unknown subject, but aren't the subject themselves, distant relatives. And then you work outward. Who are these people related to? Can you build a family tree that eventually narrows to a single person? Augustin and Dupuy spent about a year and a half building family trees from the matches that came back, and for most of that time, they were hitting dead ends. Then they expanded their search to Europe.
So that's where they found this partial match with a distant relative who lived in Romania with the last name Gligor.
The name rang a bell. Detective Augustin located a tip from way back in 2001 in the original case file about a man named Eugene Gligor. A woman who lived across the street from the Gligor residence had called police 9 months after the killing and said, "You might want to check out this kid, Eugene. I think he might be involved in the killing."
He had been on the interview sheet. Someone had submitted his name, but investigators at that time, from what we were told, went to where he grew up. They couldn't find him, and it just kind of went away.
Sandy and Lauren Prier had no idea that someone suggested Eugene Gligor could have been involved in Leslie's death. If they'd been told, they probably wouldn't have believed it anyway. They knew Eugene well. He was a nice kid who had been over for dinner countless times. He had gone on family vacations with the Priers. He was also Lauren Prier's high school boyfriend. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Bowl and Branch. Hey, Scott, question for you. Who wins the battle for the waffle blanket in our house?
I mean, me. Every night. I've basically claimed it as mine.
He's not wrong. It's this lightweight, breathable Bowl and Branch blanket, and it's somehow the coziest thing in the house without ever feeling hot, which matters a lot in the summer.
Turns out that's not an accident. Bowl and Branch's products are famous for striking that balance. We have their signature sheets, and they're 100% organic cotton woven specifically for airflow, not just softness.
It's not some synthetic cooling gimmick either. The cooling is literally built into how the cotton is woven. It makes such a difference.
And 94% of their customers say the sheets get softer with every wash, which, same. Ours have gotten better over time.
We love it so much, we're about to order comforters. Two of them, actually, since we figured out we both sleep better in the same bed, but under our own separate bedding, because Scott's what you'd call a restless sleeper.
It's true. Once you try Bowl and Branch, I don't think you're going to go back to regular sheets. Sleep cooler this summer with Bowl and Branch. Get 15% off your first order plus free shipping at bowlandbranch.com/COTC with code COTC.
That's Bowl and Branch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com/COTC, code COTC to unlock 15% off.
bowlandbranch.com/COTC, code COTC. Exclusions apply.
There's this thing in criminal investigations that I talk about a lot, both on this podcast and my other investigative pod, What If They're Wrong After the Accusation? It's tunnel vision. I talk about it almost as much as I talk about confirmation bias. The original investigators in this case really thought Sandy Prier was good for it. He and his wife had had problems. They had fought. He'd quote-unquote lost it at one point by grabbing her shoulders and at another by tossing some wine. They had financial troubles too. And to investigators, Sandy was swimming in motive. But then came that pesky DNA evidence to throw a wrench into what likely could have been a wrongful conviction. I mean, even the new detectives, Dupuy and Augustin, told Ramos,
had it not been for that unidentified male DNA under her fingernails and in the crime scene, he probably would have been charged.
Which is amazing in hindsight. All along, they had physical evidence that someone else was in that house. Someone Leslie had fought with. And rather than reorienting the investigation around that evidence, investigators kept Sandy in their sights and spent years trying to find a way to make the math work. It never did. It couldn't. He was innocent. And Leslie's family, that extended network of aunts and uncles and cousins from a big, close military family, cut ties with him.
Not only did Sandy lose his wife in the most horrific way, but he lost a big chunk of his family.
Meanwhile, Eugene Gligor was already in the case file. Eugene and Lauren had been teenagers when they dated, a first love type situation. Lauren thought he was handsome, with dark hair and a broad smile. He was sweet and generous. They stayed together about 3 years, breaking up during college, a typical ending for a high school relationship. It was amicable. When Leslie died, Eugene's family attended the funeral, though Eugene himself didn't come. Lauren noticed, but didn't think too much about it. I mean, people handle death in different ways, and Leslie had been, for a time, something of a surrogate mom to Eugene. Maybe he couldn't handle being at her funeral, or maybe he just didn't like funerals in general. Who knows? It didn't bother Lauren. She didn't hear from Eugene for years, though they did have an encounter a few years ago at a restaurant. Lauren told Ramos,
"He just came up and he was like, 'Hi.' I was like, 'Hey, I haven't seen you in so long.' Looked me right in the eyes. And I was like, 'How have you been?' He was like, 'I got married again.' I said, 'Well, that's great.' You know, just casual conversation."
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a big deal. I didn't think anything of it. We hugged, like, "Good to see you. Bye."
Soon after that, DuPuy and Augustine learned the Gligor connection to their DNA. Still, though, they didn't know for sure that it was Eugene's DNA. They only knew that the DNA led them to a family in Romania that had a surname that matched an ex-boyfriend's of Lauren's, who some lady at some point thought was suspicious enough to call in a tip about. And you can hear how tenuous that sounds. To prove that this wasn't merely a coincidence, the investigators would need to collect his DNA and compare it to the profile collected at the crime scene. And they decided they wanted to do that on the sly.
This honestly should be turned into a movie too, because it is just so interesting how they were able to isolate him.
It goes like this. Investigators learned that Gligor had been traveling overseas and he was set to return to Dulles Airport in June 2024. They watched him through airport surveillance cameras to spot him, found him, and then approached.
They pull him to the side and they say, "Hey, we need to talk to you for a little bit."
He was led into a room and left alone for a few minutes.
They leave bottles of water there for him in this room, basically just hoping that he takes a sip. And he did. He takes a sip, discards the bottle, and that's what investigators have to work with.
They fish the bottle from the trash.
And they test it, and investigators are able to find that there is a match. There is a match. It is the same exact DNA that was found at the crime scene in 2001. They have it now in 2024.
Just days later, on June 18th, 2024, they approached Gligor's home and found him sitting on the front steps of his apartment building on a trendy street in Washington, D.C. They told him he was under arrest. Now, in researching this case, I can say it seems like there are basically just two people who wouldn't have been surprised by Gligor's arrest: the woman who called the tip in 2001, and maybe Sandy Prier. Leslie Prier always liked her daughter's boyfriend, but Sandy wasn't a fan. He used to tell Lauren that something was a bit off about that guy. But everyone who knew Gligor in 2024 was shocked.
There was one former coworker of his that we spoke with that considered him a mentor. And he was also shocked that Eugene Gligor had anything to do with this, that was responsible for the death of Leslie. And he told us that this was a man that was always just talking about bettering himself. He recommended a self-help guide. He was just the most zen quality mentor.
Gligor had struggled with drugs and alcohol in his youth. He had run-ins with police, but none that got his DNA uploaded to CODIS, hence no hit on him in the system. But in the intervening years, he had kicked his habits and gone to AA and was considered a success story. He had stayed in the DC area, held a steady job, and was
completely zen.
When DuPuy and Augustine interviewed him, they started off by saying, "Well, we're revisiting the case and interviewing lots of people, and for some reason, you were never interviewed, so we're doing that now." And he said,
I'm a little confused. So to find out more and talk to me, why not just call me and ask me to come in and talk to me versus have marshals come and arrest me and bring me in? I'm just confused as to why that's the case.
Well, because we needed to talk to you in a controlled environment, and because there's a little bit more to it than what we've told you so far.
Before they even got to the DNA part, he said,
I feel a little bit trapped here, like...
Well, you're under arrest, so you should feel trapped.
Right, okay. And so I think probably asking for a lawyer is my best course of action at this point.
And then things got emotional.
I don't want to incriminate myself with questions. You guys are professionals. I'm not. I don't know. I really do think I need an attorney. I need to use the phone and I need to call someone and I need legal representation before I respond to anything else.
Okay, that's fine. We're not going to ask you any more questions. There's no tears coming out of your face.
I'm very dry right now.
You're dry?
I'm very dry. I'm parched. I'm dehydrated.
You
can probably
water.
See my eyes are bloodshot red because I'm just tired and drained. I don't know what's going on. You want me to drink water so I can tear? What the fuck is wrong with you?
I don't want you to tear.
It was all very dramatic, but not for long. Gligor eventually talked. He said that after a night of drinking and cocaine, he went to the Prier house. He couldn't remember why, but he remembered being there and going inside. He did not remember killing Leslie Prier, he said. He had been blacking out. He had no memory of what happened inside the house. But he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in May 2025. He was sentenced to 22 years in prison. He was 45 years old at the time, meaning he could be as old as 67 before he's released, though in reality, he'll probably get out sooner. He'll be on probation for 5 years when he does. Investigators spent years, 16 years, until Sandy died, convinced they understood why Leslie Prier was killed. Financial stress, a difficult marriage, a wife who drank, arguments. They had a story. It was coherent, it held together, and it was also wrong. Meanwhile, the man who actually killed Leslie Prier has never offered a motive. Police speculate now that maybe he'd gone to the Priers to rob them and kill Leslie because she could identify him. But that's just their guess. The motive is a question mark. Which brings me to this. Circumstantial evidence is useful in prosecutions, no question. But sometimes it can also muddy things. It can convince experienced investigators that they know what happened in a room they weren't in. And it can be completely wrong. Sandy Prier lost his wife, lost his extended family, and carried the weight of communal suspicion for the last 16 years of his life. He died in 2017 without knowing who killed Leslie and without anyone in authority saying clearly, "We know it wasn't you." The detectives who finally got there, Augustine and DuPuy, said that clearing Sandy was among the most meaningful things to come out of their work on the case. Better late than never. To research this case, I relied on ABC News reporter Stephanie Ramos to walk me through it. Thank you to her for the interview and for access to Blood and Water, which is a great limited-run podcast that you should check out to learn more. There's plenty of stuff in there that didn't fit here. Additional sourcing for this episode includes contemporaneous and recent reporting from The Washington Post, The Bethesda Magazine, and a few local TV stations. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.